in the limelight.
Mounting challenges will make the coming months critical for President Biden's environmental agenda, analysts say. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Lisa Friedman, who reports on federal climate and environmental policy. The piece is titled, Biden Overpromised and Underdelivered on Climate. Now trouble looms in 2022. As the new year opens, President Biden faces an increasingly narrow path to fulfill his ambitious goal of slashing the greenhouse gases generated by the United States that are helping to warm the planet to dangerous levels. His Build Back Better Act, which contains $555 billion in proposed climate action, is in limbo on Capitol Hill. The Supreme Court is set to hear a pivotal case in February that could significantly restrict his authority to regulate the carbon dioxide that spews from power plants and is driving climate change. And the midterm elections loom in November, threatening his party's control of Congress. Since Republicans have shown little appetite for climate action, a Republican takeover of one or both chambers could freeze movement for years. The mounting challenges make the next few months critical to secure the safety of the planet as well as President Biden's climate legacy, analysts are saying. If they can't pull this off, then we have failed. The country has failed the climate test, said John Podesta, a former senior counselor to President Barack Obama and founder of the Center for American Progress, a left-leaning think tank. Mr. Podesta praised the Biden administration for making a global warming a priority, creating a White House Office of Domestic Climate Policy, appointing an international climate envoy to reassert U.S. leadership on the global stage, moving forward a handful of regulations and proposing major investments in clean energy. But John Podesta also noted that the physics of climate change is unforgiving. The planet has already warmed an average of 1.1 degrees Celsius compared with the temperatures before the Industrial Revolution. If temperatures continue to rise past 1.5 degrees Celsius, the likelihood of the increasingly deadly wildfires, floods, heat waves, and other disasters becomes unavoidable, scientists have warned. Countries must immediately and drastically reduce their greenhouse gas emissions caused by burning of fossil fuels such as oil, gas, and coal if the world is to avert the most catastrophic impacts, experts are saying. At international climate talks in Glasgow last year, President Biden pledged that the United States, the world's biggest polluter in historical terms, would cut its emissions at least 50% below 2005 levels by the end of this decade. He urged other countries to take similar steps, but that will be a hard sell if the United States fails to act by the time countries gather for the next climate talks in Egypt this November. If you can't meet the goal, you've lost credibility internationally, John Podesta said, adding that he would grade Joe Biden's first year on climate policy as an incomplete. When he entered the White House, Joe Biden identified climate change as one of four priorities, along with battling the coronavirus pandemic, strengthening the economy, and addressing racial inequity. It was a dramatic reversal after the tenure of President Donald Trump, who frequently mocked climate science, sought to expand oil and gas drilling, and loosened a raft of environmental regulations, including those governing greenhouse gas emissions. The most important thing that Joe Biden did was to draw a sharp contrast with his predecessor within the first days of his presidency, said Senator Chris Coons, Democrat of Delaware, who has close ties to President Biden. Mr. Biden immediately rejoined the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement, in which nearly 200 countries pledged to try to hold temperature rise well below 2 degrees Celsius. He cancelled permits for the Keystone XL pipeline, which would have run 1,209 miles from the Canadian oil sands to Nebraska. He paused new leases for oil and gas drilling on public lands and in federal waters, and called for increasing renewable energy production, with the goal of doubling offshore wind power by 2030. Joe Biden installed longtime climate advocates in key positions and made tackling the climate crisis a priority across the federal government. The early flurry of efforts culminated in a virtual summit in April, at which Joe Biden corralled world leaders to make new pledges to cut carbon dioxide emissions. On Capitol Hill, though, President Biden led passage of a $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill that included billions for clean energy research and making communities more resilient to disasters, although it will do little to reduce carbon emissions. However, cracks in President Biden's agenda quickly appeared. In June, a federal judge in Louisiana sided with the Republican attorneys general from 13 states who argued that Joe Biden lacked the legal authority to pause new oil and gas leases. As gasoline prices surged in the summer and fall, the White House sought to increase oil production, even as President Biden implored world leaders to stop burning fossil fuels. Just days after the Glasgow climate talks, the Biden administration auctioned off nearly 80 million acres in the Gulf of Mexico, a record for that location, for offshore drilling, despite a campaign promise by Joe Biden that he would end drilling on federal lands and federal waters. White House officials said they were legally compelled to hold the lease sale, which the Interior Department said had the potential to yield 1.12 billion barrels of oil and 4.4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas over the life of the 50-year leases. But environmental groups, joined by several Democratic lawmakers, argue that the Biden administration could have done a lot more to prevent the sale and are suing the administration to stop it. Most notably, Joe Biden failed to persuade the single Democratic holdout, Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia, to vote for his $1.7 trillion Build Back Better bill, placing its future in jeopardy in an evenly split Senate. The House passed the package back in November. In negotiations with the White House, Joe Manchin insisted that the Biden administration strip out the most muscular part of the bill, a clean electricity program that would have rewarded electric utilities that stopped burning fossil fuels in favor of wind, solar, and other clean energy, and penalized those that did not. Joe Manchin also scuttled a provision that would have prohibited most offshore oil drilling. The legislation still contains about $555 billion for other climate provisions, including $320 billion in tax incentives for producers and purchasers of wind power, solar power, and nuclear power, inducements intended to speed up a transition away from oil, gas, and coal. Analysts say it would help the United States to get at least halfway to Joe Biden's climate goals. The future of the legislation remains uncertain, although Senate Democrats said on Tuesday that they were determined to see some version of it passed this year. Objectively, he overpromised and underdelivered, said Kevin Book, managing director of Clearview Energy Partners, a Washington-based research firm. Still, Kevin Book added, while the administration did not do as much as President Biden had promised, it has taken significant first steps. However, many activists are saying they were disenchanted with the president. Joe Biden started strong with the executive actions back in January, and since then he has really been a disappointment, said Ellen Scales, a spokeswoman for the Sunrise Movement, a youth-led environmental group that helped spur a jump in young voters concerned about climate in 2020. Ellen Scales said she feared it would be difficult to turn out those voters again in November. He made a lot of promises on cutting emissions, and we question whether or not that's on track, she said, adding that it was a slap in the face to environmentalists when Joe Biden went to Glasgow to declare the United States a climate leader, only to quickly lease millions of acres in the Gulf of Mexico to oil and gas companies for drilling. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has been slow to make progress on major new environmental regulations, in part because agencies were hollowed out during the Trump administration, leaving a crush of work to fewer people. Manish Bapna, president of the Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental group, said he saw 2022 as a make-or-break year. "Most of the hard work remains ahead of us," Manish Bapna said.
Midstream.
Qasem Soleimani, the most prominent name in the struggle with global arrogance. The man of Iran who chose to fight America and Israel. The man of war and politics from Iran the Revolution to Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Palestine, Yemen, and beyond. At the beginning of 2020, the decision was taken in the White House to cross all red lines and target the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. American planes carried out the assassination meters away from Baghdad International Airport so that the man, accompanied by the deputy head of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, was martyred. The first anniversary of the martyrdom of General Soleimani passed in 2021, with America at its weakest, passing through an election that witnessed a lot of controversy and objections, which overthrew Donald Trump, who made the decision to assassinate, and brought Joe Biden, who criticized his predecessor's policies towards Iran and promised a more diplomatic course. Martyr Soleimani was responsible for handling many regional files, and so he did with great capabilities. By targeting him, America aimed to crush his accomplishments, but it is clear that steadfastness is still the main feature of Soleimani's entire axis of resistance. Indeed, the regional resistance is advancing on many fronts, while Iran perseveres and does not concede. Rather, Iran forces others to solicit negotiations with it, which means that his assassination did not provide America with the result it had hoped for. The commander excelled in military fieldwork. With his increasing military power on the one hand and his great popularity with the Iranian people and the resisting peoples of the region, especially after his main role in eliminating Daesh in Iraq and Syria and thwarting American plans that were prepared for the two countries, the United States put him on its list of terrorism and imposed sanctions on him. Israel, for its part, considered him the most dangerous figure and placed him at the top of its list of assassinations. In addition to Palestinian resistance leader Martyr Baha Abu'l-Ata and Lebanese resistance leader Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah. When the Americans took the decision to assassinate Qasem Soleimani and his companion Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, Their goal was to stop the escalation of the Axis of resistance strength and capabilities by removing the Quds Force commander, the actual mastermind and coordinator of the resistance operations against the Americans, the Israelis, and the terrorism emanating from both sides, being Daesh and its affiliates. They failed. Soleimani won martyrdom and the resistance won an inspiration that will fuel decades of steadfastness and perseverance. Welcome to the Middle East Stream, I'm Marwa Osman. Lieutenant General Hajj Qasim Soleimani is the martyr of the entire Islamic nation, and the personality of that great martyr must be known to everyone as an influential figure in the Islamic world. Martyr Soleimani's approach accomplished many achievements in various cultural and social fields, especially in vindicating the personality of this righteous martyr. What would have happened to the region and the world if Martyr Soleimani was not present on the battlefields in Syria and Iraq? The efforts of Martyr Soleimani were focused on both conventional and soft war. Martyr Soleimani's jihad and resistance, confronting terrorism and saving the lives of Muslims and Christians from the Takfiri terrorists' knives, will never be erased from the pages of history. As will his support to the oppressed Palestinian people, his fight against the Zionist occupation and Takfiri terrorists in Syria and Iraq, and his support for Yemen, which all fall within the framework of his support for the natives' right of resistance in the face of foreign occupation and aggression. Now, to discuss this issue, with us from Beirut is Dr. Yahya Ghaddar, Secretary General of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Ghaddar. Now, in his work, Martyr Soleimani combined the jihadi, military, diplomatic, moral, and humanitarian dimensions. He was the one who wears a combat jacket and a war helmet and attends the front lines with the fighters. And he was the same person who was delivering medicine and medical equipment to his economically besieged country, Iran, and to those who were besieged by terrorists as well in Iraq and Syria. 2 years after the martyrdom of this great leader, how do you describe the loss of such a great leader?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
The Axis of resistance and the resistance factions in various arenas lost a leader who was a real fighter, a clever expert, brother and father for every mujahid in every battle against American and Israeli hegemony. His loss is irreplaceable due to his personal characteristics, his virtues, his knowledge, his expertise, his humility, and his exceptional abilities. However, he succeeded in preparing generations to come and thousands of fierce fighters with the same qualities and traits he held. I mean, in fact, it's a great loss, but this loss gave birth to fierce fighters. Unfortunately, we all know that such leaders are not born to our nation by the dozen. The leader that Martyr Soleimani was brings inspiration to this region. It brings the people of West Asia hope that one day they will live to see all occupation eliminated. They have faith and hope that they will retain control of their lands and resources. They believe that it's their right to be free and independent of all intervention, and their right shall be attained by the sacrifices of Martyr Soleimani's students.
Well, Dr. Ghaddar, the commander had been doing military fieldwork for 40 years of his life. Sometimes in Salahuddin in Iraq, during the recapture of Tikrit from Daesh, and sometimes in Al-Bukamal, which was the last stronghold of Daesh in Syria, and other times he was also found in accompanying Sayyid Hassan Nasrullah, the leader of Hezbollah, the Lebanese resistance, along with Martyr Imad Mughniyi in the southern suburbs of Beirut in the 2006 July war. And maybe sometimes even meeting with Palestinian leaders, especially in Lebanon when he visited Lebanon. He was indeed the thread that connected all of this resistance in the region. Do you think that the connection is still there?
It's true, as you mentioned. Martyr Soleimani was present in every arena and battlefield, and in every war or pivotal battle. Distances never prevented him from being present nor the difference of languages and dialects, nor did the many borders and the many nationalities that took part in the fight against Takfiri terrorism. His martyrdom is an additional incentive to strengthen and develop relations between all factions. After his martyrdom, relations turned into complementarity, and the different factions united their fronts to avenge his blood by vowing to expel the American occupation from Iraq and Syria and to secure the road to Palestine in a faster, less expensive way. In the end, the axis of resistance has been established. There is no longer any possibility for any power in the world, neither the American hegemony, nor the Zionist occupation, nor the Arab treachery. No matter how ferocious they are, and how much money they spend, and no matter the fake news media they activate, after what Martyr Soleimani presented, no one will be able to change the strong alliance forces of the axis of resistance that is approaching victory step by step. God willing, it will achieve all its goals in the face of American imperialism and Zionist aggression.
Well, Dr. Ghaddad, it also became clear of the great role that he played in supporting, that Haj Qasem played in supporting and financing, training and arming various Palestinian factions who stood to confront the Israeli occupation. And this confirms the seriousness of a leader like Soleimani and a force like the Quds Force and a country like Iran in fighting Israel and in supporting the native resistance movements. Yet certain Arab propaganda emits the absolute opposite about Iran and about leader Soleimani. Has the resistance lost the media war in West Asia as the wave of normalization maybe have hit many Arab states?
Not at all. The resistance factions did not lose the media war despite all the money, effort, and maneuvers that was unfortunately offered by what they call media elites. With all this hegemony, the resistance factions did not lose the media war, but rather they won and consolidated their gains. The martyrdom of General Soleimani and the commander of the Quds Force hardened the position of the resistance. The resistance vowed to escalate its war to teach the enemies unforgettable lessons and defeat them by forcing America to withdraw from the region with its flag broken and defeated. This prompted the U.S., before evacuating the area, to order its tools and agents to unite their efforts to secure protection for their shaken regimes. This compelled these Arab regimes to announce what was once in secret out to the public. Some consider that the declaration of normalization is a victory, but that is completely false, because the Arab regimes that signed the deal of the century did so under pressure from former U.S. President Trump. Trump forced them to go public with normalization after they had been secretly agents for the Zionist entity ever since the establishment of these Arab regimes. Therefore, declaring their normalization in public is a victory for the axis of resistance and not the other way around. Therefore, the announcement of the normalization will not change the balance of power, but rather expose the traitors and weaken them. In any case, meeting of five adults does not produce a young man, and the merger of bankrupt companies does not produce a fully functioning company. The normalization and betrayal of the regimes is evidence of the strength of the resistance and the weakness of these treacherous regimes.
Well, please stay tuned with us, Dr. Ghaddad, and please also stay tuned with us because we will be talking more about this matter and specifically about the role of the Mossad that has been put out in the media for the first time, being acknowledged by the Zionist entity about the role of the Mossad in assassinating General Qasem Soleimani.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
head of the Zionist Israeli Unitary Intelligence Division, Tamir Heyman, revealed that the Mossad played a vital role in the assassination of the former commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Quds Forces, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, according to a report published by a magazine closely affiliated with the Israeli intelligence services. Now, according to that report, Heyman indicated that his tenure as head of the intelligence division witnessed two important, what he called, liquidations. One of which was the assassination of Commander Soleimani, and the other, the leader of the Islamic Jihad movement, Baha Abul Atta, who was assassinated in November 2019. Now, Heyman, the now retired general who headed military intelligence until October, appears to be the first official to confirm Israel's involvement, something we really never doubted. The role of the Mossad in the assassination of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani in this following report.
Former head of the Israeli Military Intelligence Division, Tamir Heyman, revealed that the Mossad played a role in the assassination of former commander of the Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in January 2020. This was the first public acknowledgement of Israel's role in the operation by a Zionist official. Heyman even stressed that, quote, his tenure as head of the intelligence division witnessed two important liquidations, one of which was the killing of Commander Soleimani, and in the other, the leader of the Islamic Jihad movement, Baha Abul Atta, unquote, who was assassinated in November 2019. A week after the assassination of Martyr Soleimani by U.S. drone operators, the American NBC News reported that Israeli intelligence helped confirm the details of Soleimani's flight from Damascus to Baghdad. Earlier this year, Yahoo News reported that Israel had access to Soleimani's numbers and gave that intelligence to the United States. But Tamir Heyman, the now retired general who headed military intelligence until October, appears to be the first official to confirm Israel's involvement. Heyman's comments were published in the November issue of a Hebrew language magazine closely affiliated with Israel's intelligence services. The interview was held in late September, a couple weeks before his retirement from the military. The authors wrote that Heyman opened the interview by talking about the American airstrike that killed Soleimani, but in which Israeli intelligence played a part. Assassinating Soleimani was an achievement, since our main enemy, in my eyes, are the Iranians. This is what Heyman told the magazine. He said that there were two significant and important assassinations during my term as head of Army Intelligence. Heyman called Soleimani, quote, the engine of the train of Iranian entrenchment, end quote, in neighboring Syria, adding that Israel has carried out multiple operations to disrupt the spread of Iranian weapons and funds throughout the region. Heyman's interview was published as the P5+1 and Iran were engaged in negotiations to reach a new JCPOA. The previous deal, struck in 2015, unraveled after the United States unilaterally withdrew in 2018 and reimposed crippling economic sanctions on Iran. Israeli occupation officials consistently remained mum on the strike, only to say that the killing was a stabilizing event in the region for the near future that would provide Israel with a window of opportunity to increase its operations against what Zionists call Iranian entrenchment. However, as time passes, more details are being revealed about the assassination, as Axios reported that former U.S. President Donald Trump told Israeli journalist Barak Ravid that he felt manipulated by Tel Aviv, stating that he was, quote, very disappointed in Israel having to do with that event, end quote, and that former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had been willing to fight Iran to the last American soldier.
Now, still with us in the studio in Beirut is Dr. Yahya Ghaddar, Secretary General of the Global Gathering in support of the Choice of Resistance, to talk about the role of the Mossad in assassinating a leader like Qasem Soleimani. Dr. Ghaddar, assassinating Soleimani was an achievement, since our main enemy, in my eyes, are the Iranians. This is what Tamir Heyman, the now retired general who headed Israel's military intelligence, announced last month. Does it come as a surprise for you that Israel has had a hand in assassinating leader Soleimani and his comrade Haj Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis?
It's not surprising at all, the Israeli role in the assassination of Commander Soleimani, as it always has a hand in all the conspiracies, bombings, acts of sabotage, chaos, and attacks in Libya, Yemen, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and elsewhere. America and Israel are complementary in conspiracy and hostility towards Arabs, Muslims, and free nations of the world. This Israeli recognition did not surprise us at all. Rather, we believe that this recognition will call for a response from the resistance axis. Just as the response began directly after the assassination of Commander Soleimani and his companions, and the response continues according to the terms of the resistance axis, which works to remove the American occupation entity from Iraq and Syria and the Israeli occupation from Palestine.
Well, the timing of the interview was a bit interesting because the interview was published as the P5 plus one and Iran were engaged in negotiations to reach a new JCPOA in Vienna. Since the previous deal, which was struck in 2015, was unilaterally unraveled by the United States of America, who withdrew in 2018 because this is how Trump felt about it. And he reimposed crippling economic sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran. Why was this interview published at this specific timing, in your opinion?
Without a doubt, the Zionist entity is working hard with all its might to thwart putting this nuclear agreement back on track. It might be an unintended coincidence, but it may also be an attempt by Israel to invest in the negotiations and seek to sabotage them. Israel is terrified and defeated. It's afraid of America returning submissively to the nuclear agreement, which it unilaterally withdrew from during the Trump administration. When we hear all the leaders of this entity talking about the nuclear agreement, we see that they are already in great confusion due to the ongoing negotiations. Therefore, they are trying by all means to obstruct America's return to this nuclear agreement. We must not underestimate the role of global Zionism, which dominates political decisions in the United States and to a large extent in Europe as well, especially in France recently. Therefore, they are trying all possible ways to delay any agreement process. The Israelis consider that if they cannot prevent this agreement, then at least delaying this agreement for a few months or even years is a victory for them. Therefore, we see that negotiations taking place are taking much longer than expected. But at the same time, the Islamic Republic of Iran is not in a hurry. It has its own conditions. If Americans are able to achieve these conditions, the first of which is the removal of all sanctions, only then will Iran be able to accept a return to the nuclear agreement.
Well, Dr. Ghaddar, according to the Iranian-Iraqi Joint Investigation Committee on the file of the assassination of Commander Soleimani and his companions, all possible judicial and legal measures will be taken to prosecute and to punish what they called the perpetrators and the elements involved in this crime and the assassinations. Will that be enough to curb the Israeli-U.S. urge to commit similar crimes and similar violations in the near future?
No, never. This will not be sufficient and will not constitute elements of force to prevent Israel and America from committing more assassinations and aggressions. We believe that what was taken by force can only be recovered by force. These are the words of the late leader Jamal Abdel Nasser. The resistance alone is the compelling and deterrent response. And this is what Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah announced on behalf of the resistance factions. Sayyid Nasrallah said the call of the ultimate response by expelling the Americans from Iraq and Syria by force and resistance. There is no other way but resistance. This does not negate the fact that the legal work made by the Iraqi-Iranian committee is not important, not at all. Their work is very important, especially as an evidence in front of international human rights organizations. The criminal act of terrorism that was committed by America with the help of Israel should always be dealt with both on the field and in the courtroom. However, working only in the courtroom is not enough. The Americans have no place amongst the peoples of this nation. This region is tired of their imperialism. Palestine is tired of Zionism. Both should be eliminated, and it will happen in our lifetime, God willing.
Dr. Ghaddar, Iran has always been dismissed by the West as Israel's main threat in the region of West Asia, but so far there has been multiple provocations by the Israeli entity against the Islamic Republic of Iran, from assassinations to open aggressions to sabotage, and it doesn't seem to be backing down anytime soon. Is there a possibility that Israel might actually push to ignite what it has always worked hard for achieving, which is a global direct war against the Islamic Republic of Iran?
The options before the usurping entity are very few, but still there is a very weak possibility, but an irrational possibility, like that of a suicide bomber who dragged the world into a war against the Islamic Republic of Iran. If this war takes place, it would be like the day of resurrection. If this war takes place, it will change everything that preceded it, and it will practically be in the interest of the axis of resistance and the interest of the Arab and Islamic nation, which will be liberated once and for all from all forms of imperialism and colonialism. That is why we believe that this war, if it occurs, will only be in the interest of the resistance axis in West Asia and will be translated as a crushing victory for the resistance axis and a brutal defeat for American imperialism and Zionism and their tools of Arab treacherous regimes.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Dr. Yahya Ghaddar, Secretary General of the Global Gathering in support of the Choice of Resistance, for being with us to talk about the second anniversary of the loss of a very important leader to the entire West Asian region. Thank you very much for your contribution. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East stream. Please be safe. Assalamu alaikum.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Over the past year, the UK has taken a number of steps, aligning itself much closer with the US and the Zionist regime than its own past positions. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Omar Karmi Ryder. This article is titled, UK Pivots to the Zionist Regime in Post-Brexit Scramble. Stay tuned for more. What a difference 5 years and mass delusional collective self-harm on a geopolitical scale can do to a country and its diplomacy. In the aftermath of the Zionist regime's full-on military assault on Gaza in 2014, British parliamentarians voted to recognize a Palestinian state. It may not have been binding on the government of the day or have gone far enough. But the motion passed without fuss and suggested mainstream acceptance of and sympathy for at least part of the Palestinian narrative, which is no more than one might expect from a country that created the whole mess in the first place. In 2015, the Labour Party, the UK's only real opposition party, then elected Jeremy Corbyn, a longtime proponent of Palestinian rights, as leader. Fast forward several years, however, and the landscape looks dramatically different. Over the past year, the UK has taken a number of steps, aligning itself much closer with the US and the Zionist regime than its own past positions. The UK and the Zionist regime have just signed a strategic plan entirely devoid of strings or demands on the Zionist regime. At about the same time, and for the first time ever, the UK abstained from an annual UN vote on the status of Al-Quds. In November, London announced a comprehensive ban on Hamas, including its political wing, reversing decades of British efforts to make the UK an important interlocutor between Hamas and Western countries. The UK is also actively opposing attempts to hold the Zionist regime accountable at the International Criminal Court, ICC, even though it is quite clear and well documented that the fake regime of Israel is unable or unwilling to investigate itself. What happened? In a word, Brexit. In more words, beggars can't be choosers. From its carefully constructed mid-Atlantic perch, part of the world's largest trading bloc, while enjoying a special relationship with the Oval Office, the 2016 referendum narrowly rejecting EU membership has turned Britain into an insular and floundering island state running on colonial nostalgia fumes. The UK has been well and truly downgraded by a succession of second-rate politicians and chancellors, none more so than the current Prime Minister, who had two op-eds ready for publication just ahead of the referendum, one for, one against. So poorly conceived has Brexit been that Boris Johnson's government is now in danger of breaking international law over Northern Ireland. London is trying to square the circle of maintaining an open border in Ireland as per the Good Friday Agreement, while keeping intact UK territorial cohesion over an area effectively still in the EU's customs area. While alienating traditional European allies, London is also getting no traction on any preferential free trade treatment in the US. First, Barack Obama opposed the UK leaving the EU, then Johnson provoked the anger of Donald Trump, in spite of his apparent initial fondness, and now Joe Biden has effectively told London to get in line. The UK needs new friends, and pronto. The UK Zionist regime strategic partnership agreement, setting out a roadmap for cooperation in the areas of diplomacy, defense and security, cyber, science, technology, is partly a consequence. But it likely would not have happened without the Abraham Accords, which saw Persian Gulf countries move ever closer to the fake regime of Israel. Persian Gulf, States are crucial investors in the UK. Their importance has only increased over the past year since Brexit, when foreign investment has steadily declined. The UAE recently promised the UK some $14 billion in investments over the next 5 years. Such investments might, in the past, have swayed the UK government's hand in favor of the Arabists in the Foreign Office, those who might have cautioned against too close a relationship with the Zionist regime in order not to alienate Arab allies and investments. No more. With Bahrain and the UAE having normalized relations with the Zionist regime and Saudi Arabia signaling its intent to do so all but formally, closeness to the Zionist regime no longer carries any political or economic risk for an inward-looking, cash-strapped UK. The Zionist regime is not a particularly big trade partner for the UK, but closer ties with the Zionist regime now come with no fear of regional repercussions, and Palestinian protests no longer find purchase among the UK opposition. London already knows what the Zionist regime tech can do, so why not? And just as the UAE calculated when normalizing relations with the Zionist regime last year, London might also feel this could curry favor in some of the many corridors of power in Washington. But this is diplomacy by desperation, and it perfectly reflects the caliber of politician that has been running the UK since Brexit. Perhaps no one typifies the kind of Johnson loyalist that has thrived since Brexit better than Priti Patel, the Home Secretary. Patel was forced to resign her cabinet post as International Development Secretary by Theresa May, Johnson's predecessor, after holding unofficial meetings with the Zionist regime officials and business leaders while supposedly on holiday. She has since, with the intervention of Johnson, survived a bullying scandal that in the past would have forced another resignation or sacking. Patel is the proud progenitor of a controversial clause to the UK's nationality and borders law that would grant the Home Secretary the power to strip foreign-born dual nationals, like her own parents, of their citizenship without notice. Such moves play to a far-right conservative constituency that is the ascendancy in the UK. Similarly, Patel's bill proscribing Hamas' political wing is also intended to boost her political fortunes. The bill will have little effect on Hamas, but it could make a difference to pro-Palestine activism in the UK, since it is now illegal to voice support, however defined, for Hamas. It will also make a difference to British diplomatic efforts and any back channels already established with Hamas through British citizens or non-governmental organizations that may no longer be workable under the new legislation. Patel has been joined in this pro-Israel frenzy by the Foreign Secretary. Liz, blessed are the cheesemaker's trust. December's Al-Quds vote came under trust, though diplomatic sources tell the Electronic Intifada that the abstention had been signaled long ago and that British officials were hamstrung by what appears to be a decision from the very top. A similar situation, say the same sources, obtained in May over the UK's vote against a UN Human Rights Council resolution on investigating the Zionist regime human rights violations. Truss, whose political rise seems unconnected to any particular political achievement, may not be to blame for these previous votes, but she did have the distinction of signing the new Zionist regime trade deal and of penning a joint op-ed with Yair Lapid, the Zionist regime foreign minister, which did not mention the Palestinians or the Zionist regime's military occupation of any territory even once. This is quite an achievement, and by so completely delinking UK Zionist regime relations from any Israeli behavior in occupied territory or anywhere else, the UK's pivot to carte blanche US-style pro-Israel bias is almost complete. Labour MPs and leaders, meanwhile, appear to have taken just one lesson from the anti-Semitism controversy that embroiled the party for years under Corbyn, taking up the mantle of Palestinian rights, and by extension, the equal and global application of human rights is simply not worth it. Thus, with the Labour Party offering nothing for Palestinians or Palestinian rights or even a bulwark against the Zionist regime expansionism or the Zionist regime's version of apartheid, the UK has rendered itself an irrelevance as merely another example of US-style bipartisanship on the issue. It is a loss to Palestinians and those who agitate on their behalf, certainly, but it is perhaps a greater loss to any chance of the UK ever being seen as anything other than a minor Washington enforcer.
A senior Iranian lawmaker
has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
He was assassinated in 2020, but Qasem Soleimani's legacy continues and has been kept alive via regional operations, in hearts and minds of Muslims, and by days of TV broadcasts in the run-up to his two-year anniversary. Known for piety and courage, even his enemies had a good word to put in for him. Enemies such as Israel and America, to whom he was a thorn in the side in West Asia. Media on the martyr and the resistance includes an exhibition at Tehran's Holy Defense Museum with lifelike models of warplanes and ships and the like, and a wax effigy of the general I could have sworn was alive as I looked on, waiting for the crew to set up camera. What triggered Soleimani's resistance-related legacy was the 1980s eight-year Iraq-Iran war, in which Iraq received every support imaginable from America and an American-led world. To Haj Qasem, it was enough is enough. We are not taking one more battering from America or its lackeys. For more on the man and his mission, stay with me, Leila Faramazi, on Iran Today, on the occasion of the second anniversary of an assassination. Along his way, Soleimani set his sights on the day the United States of America is expelled from this region. In fighting terror groups created or propped up by the U.S., funny thing is, Soleimani's death was no less effective in weakening the American position and grip in West Asia than his will in life. Soleimani was shot together with nine others, including Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, the deputy head of Hashd al-Shaabi. That's Iraq's popular mobilization forces. The incident 2 years ago happened as the Iranian general was visiting Iraq at the invitation of Iraq's government to deliver an Iranian reply to a Saudi message through Iraq. The U.S. broke all sorts of laws and agreements by this act of assassination. And just 2 days later, on January the 5th, Iraq's parliament voted to expel U.S. military forces from Iraq, with parliamentarians chanting, "Yes, yes, Soleimani." Mr. Akbari, himself a general, shared with us his outlook to put into perspective General Soleimani's approaches and methods.
We believe that although martyrdom indeed means a great person is gone, the effects that they have on society and the environment around them are positive. The examples are Ashura and Karbala, when they thought that with the martyrdom of Imam Hussein and his companions and imprisonment of their families, everything including Islam was over. But that was the very time when Islam was revived. Maybe if that hadn't happened, Islam would have perished. If Imam Hussein was to surrender, Islam would be over. Many thought that the martyrdom of Qasem Soleimani would mean the end of many things. The Americans believed they would consolidate their power in Iraq. After the martyrdom of Haj Qasem, we are witnessing a series of events. The US decided to leave Iraq, and the resistance persisted, which now means Americans have to leave.
On the 8th of January, a day after his funeral procession, Iran retaliated with a major missile attack on the Ain al-Assad and another Iraqi base where U.S. troops were stationed. It was called Operation Martyr Soleimani. Iran's showering the U.S. Ain al-Assad air base in Iraq's western governorate of Al-Anbar with tens of ground-to-ground missiles left more than 100 U.S. service members with traumatic brain injury, TBI. The assassination was ordered by former U.S. President Trump. He had reportedly mulled over the idea of removing Soleimani simply over a game of golf, having been motivated by his Foreign Secretary Pompeo's unbacked speculations. Speculations of Soleimani being a danger to American lives. Following its retaliatory response, Iran announced the new strategy of continuing what General Soleimani had assiduously started, the expulsion of U.S. forces from the region. That would be the real revenge. Some 2 years later, in a statement on the second anniversary of the Soleimani assassination, this is what the Iranian Foreign Ministry said. The prompt and effective action of the armed forces of the Islamic Republic of Iran in slapping the American troops stationed at the Ain al-Assad base in Iraq in the face, along with the spiritual effects of the blood of Iranian and Iraqi martyrs, upset the equations and brought about the failure of U.S. regional strategy. The U.S. fleeing from Afghanistan, the beginning of the process of withdrawal from Iraq, and the change in the strategy of the U.S. military presence in the geostrategic region of Persian Gulf showcase a small part of such impacts and consequences. The Foreign Ministry added, "Undoubtedly, the criminal act of the United States in martyring General Soleimani is a clear manifestation of a terrorist attack that was orchestrated and carried out in an organized manner by the then U.S. government, for which the White House is now responsible." Now, Iran and Iraq have formed a joint judicial committee to bring to justice the perpetrators behind the assassination. Countries other than the United States were also involved in the act of state terrorism, according to the Secretary of Iran's Judiciary's Human Rights Council, Kazem Gharibabadi. Mr. Shirazi was a brother-at-arms to Qasem Soleimani, so we traveled from west to east of Tehran metropolis to hear it from someone in the know.
The President of the United States personally decided to assassinate him. Trump was Haj Qasem's opponent. The world-renowned commander was more popular amongst the armed forces than any other commander. He was more popular than any political figure in Iran except for the leader of the Islamic Revolution. It would be very natural for such a person to lose all humility. But when his mother passed away, she passed away before his father. I was there for a funeral in Qanat Malik. They were setting up security gates to check people who wanted to attend the funeral. When Haj Qasem realized that, he came to the gates saying that people who are there to give their condolences should not get into trouble and removed all the gates. He did the same in Kerman and Tehran for his father's funeral. People would go visit him, especially when he went to Kerman. The people of Kerman knew him for 50 years. He was always tired whenever he returned from Kerman. He'd say people would go to him with their problems until late at night. If he didn't help them, who else would?
Iran submitted a 300-page document on the Soleimani assassination to Iraq, and Iran and Iraq issued a joint statement on December the 25th, according to which both countries insisted the terror attack on the general and companions was a violation of international law, including conventions on countering terrorism, and so it carries international responsibility. The third Joint Research Committee on the assassination is going to be held in Baghdad by early to mid-February. To attend more to background on the making of the man and what set him on his mission, Soleimani was just a youngster with no more than a high school diploma at the time of the Iraq-Iran war. But he joined the front and quickly rose in the ranks, and in 1998, he became head of the Quds Force with its